so excited to talk to our guest today. In this world that is really inundated with conflicting information and then amidst the looming federal election, navigating the complexities of agriculture law and policy can truly be daunting. And that's why I'm so excited to delve into this discussion featuring a senior staff attorney at the National Agricultural Law Center, hailing from a family farm in Cogar, Oklahoma, with a background in agribusiness and Juris Doctorate from University of Oklahoma, along with an LLM in Agricultural Law from the University of Arkansas. Our guest brings a wealth of experience and insight to the table. So we're going to discuss the critical issues facing agriculture in 2024 and the importance of separating fact from hype. I'd like to welcome Rusty Rumley. Welcome, Rusty, and thank you so much for being here. I've been really looking forward to this conversation.
Hey, thanks, Chrissy, and I'm glad to be here.
So I met you last year at the American Society of Agriculture Consultants Conference, where you gave an outstanding presentation. It was looking forward to 2024. And now I want to share some of that here on the podcast of what I learned. But let's start first with your background. How did you get where you are today?
So like you mentioned, I grew up on a cow-calf operation in western Oklahoma. I always kind of knew that I wanted to be involved in agriculture. The thought was early on, I'd probably take over the family farm, but then I ended up, a livestock judging coach talked me into going down the path of ag law, and following his advice, that's kind of how I ended up on the path that I'm currently on.
That's so awesome. And your wife is also involved in the same industry. You must have interesting dinner discussions.
Yeah. I mean, as interesting as two lawyers can have on a pretty detailed subject area. But yeah, she actually grew up on a family farm in Michigan doing specialty crops. So it has two completely different types of farming backgrounds. So definitely is an interesting when she helps with working calves and I help a little bit in the specialty crops. It's definitely a different experience for us.
I guess. Yeah. And it's, I guess the industry is lucky to have you both. It's great to have people with, from grassroots, right?
So it really helps.
Yeah. So let's start out. We're going to go through a bunch of the issues that you covered in your presentation and issues that are really relevant to 2024. So let's start with water.
Okay.
The last few years has been a roller coaster ride, to say the least, on this issue. So can you break down what's happened in the WOTUS saga, really starting with the Obama administration through the Trump years and then to where we are today with the recent Sackett versus EPA decision?
So I'd probably start one step before that. And we got what we called the main body of the WOTUS back in the 1980s, really. What that is, so you got the Federal Clean Water Act. And everyone hears about WOTUS. What is WOTUS? It stands for Waters of the United States. But really all it is the federal government only has jurisdiction against certain bodies of water. And the way that the Congress defined it is, they're going to have jurisdiction over navigable waters. Okay, what's a navigable water? Congress graciously, clearly defined it and said it is a water of the United States. So that's the only bodies of water that they can enforce the Clean Water Act as a water of the United States. So basically, for almost 40-some years, we've been fighting over what is a water of the United States. There's some things that we know are a water of the United States. The Mississippi River, the Colorado River, clearly those are navigable bodies of water. Multiple states rely on them, no question. But then you start getting into, and we know there's bodies of water that don't relate to anything. So an isolated farm pond in the middle of nowhere, no connection to interstate commerce. But then you get into a lot of the gray areas, streams, creeks. Well, what if it's a creek that doesn't run all year? What if it only runs during flooding events? What about the marshes and wetlands that are next to those types of erosional features or things like that? So applying this concept of what is a water of the United States is actually really, really tricky. And people have fought over these details for decades. So the last time the Supreme Court took a swipe at waters of the United States back in 2006, the court basically said in a footnote, like, hey, Army Corps of Engineers and EPA, why don't you guys go out there and define what a water of the United States is? And during the Obama administration, EPA and the Corps, finally, they came up with a definition. It was a very, very long definition. I mean, the definition for one phrase, I mean, when you have a definition that's dozens of pages long, that's doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be an easy definition to follow. But it's a complicated area. So the litigation started after the 2015 clean water rule that the Obama administration. So basically, we've had dueling administrations since then. We've switched from Democrat to Republican, back to Democrat. So each administration has changed the rule, and then groups have immediately challenged those changes. And then finally, last year, Supreme Court weighs in on waters of the United States again in the Sackett decision. And they basically narrowed the scope of what can be considered a water of the United States. So now we need some kind of permanent connection. Before, the court, the EPA and the Corps could basically choose, do we want permanently connected bodies of water, or can we say that there is a significant nexus? And the Corps usually went with significant nexus just because it's a little bit looser phrase. So that was the decision, the Sackett case was, let's get rid of that. Let's look at relatively permanent flowing bodies of water. That's what we're going to make jurisdictional. So, and we're still dealing with that. Like, there was a lot of action in 23. We still got a lot of the states that challenged it. Over half the states challenged when Biden's administration changed the rule in January of last year. Those states have challenged the rule. So in half of the states, we're using the new Clean Water Act rule. And in the other half of the states, we are actually using the rule from the 1980s, like pre-Obama's 2015 rule. So we actually have two different standards going on right now, and we're waiting for the court situation to kind of shake out. So yeah, very long answer to a short question.
Yes. And the roller coaster continues, right?
We have a flow chart on all the different decisions and all the, it looks like a maze, but it's like a lawyer retirement issue. This one is.
And when you talk about water and farming, you have to always talk about California. They have some of arguably the most ideological water regulation and environment, I guess, out there. So what's happening in California? What are you seeing and hearing?
So with water, there's always two issues that confront agriculture. One of them is water quality. So waters of the United States kind of falls under that quality issue. The other one that you see in California and the rest of the West is water quantity issues. Those are kind of the two cues of water, quality or quantity. Quantity is becoming a huge concern and has been now for over a decade in the West, allocating an already scarce resource, what crops are going to be grown, what kind of water rights do we have, how do you square the water rights? You know, each state does their water rights differently. And then you have shared bodies of water like the Colorado River, things like that. You know, how do you square those different state water approaches to a finite resource? And it basically means someone's going to be left without water some years. Some years, and, you know, years of a good snowpack, you know, you may end up with more water than and everyone can have some. But it's in those years of prolonged drought. That's where we're starting to see the issues come up. And unfortunately, there's no clear answer on this. Water quantity cases are cases that can take, they can literally take more than a decade to resolve. I mean, these are, most people are familiar with lawsuits and they're thinking 1 to 3 years. And that's pretty common for most of your lawsuits. But when you're dealing with water rights issues, especially when it's water rights like between states, these are cases that can go on easily for decades. They can involve trips to the Supreme Court. They can just be really, really complicated. So this is one of those areas. It's probably not going to be getting better. Like, this is, the water situation's getting worse. We have more people out there. It's going to be an issue that just continues going on for the foreseeable future.
Right. And what are you seeing in terms of the ratio of people who use water and farmers is very different. So the voices of producers is low in comparison. Are you seeing any good strides in agriculture's direction, especially in California?
So not so much in California. I mean, you're always going to have the practical issue of there's going to be more voters in the suburban and urban areas than there are going to be in the rural areas. The rural areas are using a lot of water for crops. But I mean, it's really hard from a political perspective to turn off the spigots to the people in town, even if those farms have seniority water rights. So, you know, do they use something like eminent domain or something like that to take water rights? In the past, they've been successful in buying water rights away from farmers. So that's something that we've seen quite a bit in parts of Texas, Colorado, California, is municipal governments purchasing away those senior water rights that the farmers have held. But eventually, I mean, you're probably going to reach a point where the farmers aren't going to want to convey those water rights. So then how do you deal with that? When there's a shortfall, who gets curtailed? And that's going to be a question that, you know, you may get different answers from different courts. I mean, it's, water law is a pretty complex issue. Typically, the lawyers that do water law, that may be all that they do, is just they focus solely on water law. So we really don't know how this is going to shape up. I mean, you can talk to water lawyers from each state and they can give you an opinion, but then they're also dealing, especially when you're dealing with these community water rights, like, you know, the Colorado River, things like that. You know, you also get the federal government weighing in, and you may also have Native American tribes with water rights as well. So when you're dealing with various parties all coming to the table on this, it's really hard to predict what's going to come out the other side.
Yeah, that's understandable. And you just think about a river flowing through states, who owns it, where it came from, where it is, where does it, until you really think about it.
You have to keep certain minimum flows if there's an endangered species in there. So right. You may have to leave 25 to 30% of the water that's in there untouched just to maintain those species. So, I mean, you can't even divide up all the water that's in there. So,
right. Yeah, that's such a good example of conflicting regulatory ideas, I guess. And that brings me to a bill that Senator Josh Hawley has just introduced. It's known as the Protecting Interstate Commerce for Livestock Producers Act, and that's in direct opposition to California's controversial Prop 12. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that issue and what the senator is proposing?
So on that one right there, that particular bill, so there was actually another bill that was introduced earlier Senator Grassley introduced the first one, and it was it's called the acronym is known as the EATS Act, Ending Ag Trade Suppression Act. I guess it was Marshall that brought that one, that proposed that one, Senator Marshall. Grassley's been a proponent of it for years. There's not been a lot of interest in moving forward with the EATS Act just because it was fairly broadly written and it applied to more than just livestock agriculture. It really hasn't gotten a lot of traction in Congress. And there's been quite a few senators and representatives that have been filing notices that they tended to oppose it. So Senator Hawley out of Missouri has proposed another piece of legislation called the Protecting Interstate Commerce Act for Livestock Producers. It's much more narrowly tailored. It's only looking at livestock and livestock goods that are being imported into another state. And the thought is, because of the more limited ramifications for it, it might be something that might be more palatable to be passed. I did not see anything about it in the appropriations bill that was just passed, but you know, we still got a farm bill out there. So I guess the question would be, does that or something similar to that get worked into the farm bill? And you know, do we get a farm bill in 2024, since it's an election year and we're already in March? So
right. And what is your insight? You have no idea what's happening, anything?
I mean, they're working on the farm bill. Like, they've been hard at work on it. I mean, the question is just going to be, with the legislative calendars that they've got, you know, they only passed some of the appropriations bills. Some of the bigger appropriation bills are still hanging out there. So those are going to be the priority right now to get those through. So the last farm bill, well, it was actually passed during the lame duck session of Congress. So, you know, we might see something like that, but it's really hard to predict right now kind of what's going to go on. But I think the appropriations bills are the thing that's on the forefront of everyone's mind right now. And then after that, we'll see. But man, bills are really hard to pass during an election year. Yeah. And it's not just an election year, it's a presidential election year. So.
So let's move on to the Endangered Species Act. It's been giving producers heartburn forever. So can you outline where we're at, especially when it comes to EPA and pesticide regulation?
So that's been the big push on the Endangered Species Act. We've had the Endangered Species Act since the early 1970s. There really hasn't been a huge number of changes to it. For the producers out in the West, they're probably a lot more familiar with the ESA than producers in the eastern half of the United States. It seems like much more of the litigation under ESA happens in the Ninth Circuit. The big change and kind of driving from litigation in the Ninth Circuit has been for pesticides to be approved, you have to look at a federal law. It's commonly known as FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. So that's the law that controls that label that's on the side of your pesticide container. Whether it's an herbicide, insecticide, fungicide, whatever it is, it's that list of instructions that the farmer has to follow in order to safely apply that chemical. Part of that approval process and getting that label, the EPA is supposed to consult with Fish and Wildlife Service on whether that pesticide could have an impact on endangered species. And in the past, they've kind of given it a cursory glance and said, yeah, we don't think it's going to have a significant impact. Groups have challenged that, and the courts have agreed. So EPA is trying to look at this as the strategy that they're using is a little bit different, a different approach. They've released one right now. It's called the draft herbicide strategy. And what they are looking at doing is, if a state, or I mean, in order to apply a pesticide, the pesticide applicators, in order to comply with ESA, are going to have to take certain steps in order to apply these pesticides. So the things that they're looking at is mitigation measures. So for the controlling spray drift, what kind of nozzles are the farmers using? Are they using a hooded sprayer? Things like that. They're also worried about pesticides running off into creeks and rivers and killing aquatic endangered species. So they're going to be looking at things like, do you have buffer strips or filter strips alongside riverbanks? Are you doing setbacks so that you're not getting spray drift over into critical areas? Are you doing terracing or contouring the land so that you're avoiding, you know, having pesticides wash off the surface onto the end of the rivers? So this is going to be something that's going to be a big change for all the farmers out there. So in the past, you wanted to be able to follow the law. You go out, you buy a barrel of chemical. On the side of the barrel, there's a piece of plastic. You pull the plastic back and they've graciously provided a label, which really looks like a book, and you have to read the book and apply the chemical. Well, now you're also going to have to look at probably a QR code, and you're going to have to see, okay, I live in this county. So what are my restrictions? Because the restrictions that you have in this particular county, in this state, are going to look different than other producers in different states because you have different endangered species there. So It might mean you have to have a wider setback for spraying. You might have to have a more either a filter strip and terracing. Like they're going to look at, they call it the point system, but basically each of these, you know, minimal till gets you so many points. Cover crops get you so many points. And in order to apply a pesticide, you have to meet so many points, so say 6 points, and you get two points for no-till, 3 points for filter strip. Okay, now you need to do something else in order to get your 6 point. And once you get your 6 point, you can apply your herbicide of choice. So this is going to be a radical change for farmers. And like I said, right now, they're just doing it with herbicides. It's still in the draft phase, so they're basically trying to work the kinks out of the system. But this is going to be a major, major change for farmers out there. And then they're going to apply this, of course, to pesticides and fungicides as well going forward. So,
And how is it enforced?
That's a good question. It's probably going to be... in most of your states, your day-to-day enforcement is actually done by your ag department or your state environmental quality association, kind of depending upon who does it. But it's pretty common that most state ag departments control things, look at things like pesticide drift and handle complaints like that. So it's probably going to be most of your day-to-day enforcement is going to be there. But you're also going to have EPA with the ability to step in as well. So,
wow. So another issue that there's so many as we go down the list here. So right to repair is another big issue in ag law, and it's another kind of roller coaster that's been going back and forth. Where are we standing with that now?
So right to repair has been one of those perennial topics that's been, it pops up and then kind of, goes back away. We have, let's see, in the past, many of the pushes for right to repair when it comes to ag equipment have never made it across the finish line. But we actually got our first one last year, passed by Colorado, just went into effect this past January, that actually made it made the right to repair apply to ag equipment. So by what we're talking about with right to repair is the ability for farmers to be able to work on their own equipment. So work on your own tractor, work on your own air seeder, whatever it is. Usually this kind of falls into two formats. This could be, you know, some of the tractors now are being designed so that you have to have specialty tools in order to change out certain parts, or the manufacturer just doesn't sell those parts. They only make them, available at the licensed repair shops. Or the real thing that's been an issue has been software. It's like when you buy your new tractor, do you own everything in there, or do you only have a license to the software that actually runs your tractor? Can you do anything to tweak that software? What if you're having a software glitch? Who can repair it? And that's been a really contentious issue. Colorado took that first step. They have passed laws or passed the first statute dealing with this right to repair. Ag manufacturers now, you know, the small mom and pop repairmen that work on tractors are now going to have access to that data. It also affected motorized wheelchair repairs as well, which that's usually for some reason. Ag equipment and motorized wheelchairs just kind of go hand in hand when it comes to, I have no idea how those two things got wedded together, but it's fairly common to see them talk about ag equipment, motorized wheelchairs. And then the other big one is electronics. So things like, you know, can someone else work on your smartphone or your iPad, things like that. So We've started to see states kind of break away. California has been another one that passed it dealing with electronics. So, but it, you know, this has been one of those things we've heard for years, like this is going to come, it's going to come, there's going to be right to repair. It never has. And then finally last year, we started to see a little bit of a breakthrough on that matter. So that's, we're still in the early days of that, but it is something that's something that we ought to watch out for in 2024 and beyond.
Yeah, that's one of those issues where I am having a hard time finding a side in. Usually there's like a clear agriculture side. The problem is when I think about it, I think I love capitalism and I don't like government interference. So I think whatever we're asking for, we need to make sure that if we're, you know, lobbying or putting pressure on, that we're keeping our mind open to all of the consequences of whatever it is we're asking for, right?
This isn't an easy issue.
Yeah.
You know, it's farmers want to have the rights to work on their equipment. There's other things involved as well. I mean, these companies have invested a lot of money developing this software. So there's trade secrets there. They really don't want to be giving their competitors a peek at the software. There's also ways there, you know, you can change the way the tractor performs. So things like the tractors, they're having to build in and comply with fuel economy for EPA. You know, if you have access to the software, you might be able to override horsepower restrictions and things like that, that, you know, bring your fuel consumption above an applied limit. It may also cause additional stress on the machine. So, you know, if it's breaking down more often, that usually doesn't look very good for the companies if their equipment's breaking down a lot. So, I mean, it's, you can kind of, both sides have some legitimate concerns, and it's not as easy as a lot of people think at first glance.
Yeah, that's it. And then another issue that is kind of the same thing, where there's so many ways to look at it, is, and I really appreciated this in your presentation last fall, was the take on foreign land ownership in the U.S., which is, you know, has become somewhat of a trigger word for a lot of us in the industry. Your data in your presentation was surprising to a lot of us. So can you explain really the reality of what's happening there?
So we've had a long history in the United States of either prohibitions against the foreign ownership of land or the express permission of foreign ownership of land. And it really just kind of depends upon which decade of U.S. history you're looking at. We banned it early on when we just first started as a country, because we were afraid that the King of England could come over here, buy a bunch of land, and then, you know, restart the colonization process. You know, and then at different time periods, we've had different laws impacting, you know, people from certain countries or regions of the world. A lot of the Midwest has laws prohibiting foreign ownership, and they were almost all passed when the Midwest was the western boundary of the United States. So we do have a very long history of this with a lot of ups and downs. The most recent push has started in 2022. And it was, you know, basically challenging, you know, well, what foreign countries own our land? And Congress first asked this question back in the late 1970s. And the answer to Congress was, USDA said, we have no idea. We don't know who owns it. So Congress passed, we call it a FIDA. It's basically the Foreign Disclosure and Ag Act. So what they're looking at is, it doesn't prohibit foreign entities from owning land. It just says, if you're a foreign purchaser and you buy American ag land, you need to disclose to USDA that you own this. So it's basically a self-reporting system. So that's where a lot of the numbers that we talked about in the presentation last fall come from, that FIDA data on these, you know, entities self-submitting to USDA. Not a huge amount of the U.S. is owned, and I say owned. They counted both land that's owned, and they also count land that's under a long-term lease. So any lease that's 10 years or longer. That's kind of thrown off our stats. And the reason for that is we have so much land in the U.S. that's under lease for solar leasing and wind leasing. Oh. And all of that counts as a long-term lease because those are 25 to 50 years in length, typically. And a lot of them are partially owned by like the Dutch retirement system. And Germany, Siemens has a lot of, they do a lot of the work on the turbines themselves, the nacelles. So they've got ownership interests in the wind farms. So we have a quite a bit of the land out there that's, you know, being used to produce renewable energy that probably that falls under the AFIDA reporting. Right now, it's a little bit less than 3% of ag land is owned or, you know, under a long-term lease by foreign owners. The vast majority of it is actually Canadians. The Canadians own a substantial amount of timberland in the United States. So Maine, they own probably 10% of all the land that's owned by the Canadians is up in Maine, primarily timber, but a little bit of blueberries as well. They also own a lot of land down in like Louisiana, Texas, some of the deep south as well. I think most of your foreign investors are actually going to be the Canadians, the Netherlands, Italy, UK, and Germany. That's your top kind of five owners of ag land. The one we always get questions about is, you know, how much does China own? They're hovering right around 350,000 acres, which is a little bit less than 1% of the total foreign ownership. So they're 1% of 3%. So that's currently where we're at right now. The push in the last couple of years, 22, we saw a big push for people to just ban foreign ownership outright. I think a lot of people realized that, you know, there's a lot of Canadian interests, a lot of interest by these solar companies and wind companies in there from Europe. 2023, and not many of those bills actually passed back in 22. Last year, we saw a lot of momentum, and that's being carried forward into this year. They've scaled back and just say, we're not going to target foreign ownership in general. We're going to target foreign ownership by China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. Like, we're going to target those four. And that's where the push has been the last year and a half, has been focused on those countries in particular. So that's the current state of what we're seeing in foreign ownership of ag land. Most of it's being done at the state level. There is some push at the federal level, but usually your property ownership, you do that at the state. Like, you file your land deed at the county courthouse. That's not something that you get approval through USDA to do. So, I mean, there's kind of questions how much the feds can really get involved in it, since they don't typically deal with ownership of land. I mean, there are some things they can do, you know, restrict ownership near military bases, things like that. But it's something that we're following really closely here at the center.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. I bet you nobody would guess that Canadians own the most foreign-owned land.
They're the number one by far. Like, they're
that's interesting. And then I also, when you had first brought that up in your presentation, I thought, because I'm originally from Canada, and I thought, well, I owned land in the U.S. as a Canadian, just residential land, right? But as you go through, like, you know, thinking about these policies, you think, okay, well, you know, even back in during COVID in Ontario, there's Americans that own the beach houses, and they couldn't come to their house for 2 years. They weren't allowed. So who really, I don't know. There's just so much to think about when you think about land ownership, especially foreign land ownership. It's hard enough to regulate just, you know, in your city and state level.
And like I said, talking to some of the timber companies, I mean, you guys had problems with insects, especially in Western Canada a decade to 15 years ago. And it's a wise idea to diversify where you're not going to have insect problems. So a lot of this isn't just about owning foreign land. I mean, there's reasons to do it. So, and this is one of those areas, it's really complicated. Like, this is one of those, you know, agriculture is a big family. They don't always get along with each other, but this is one of those topics that actually touched everybody. Like, this impacted farmers, this impacted lenders, this impacted, you know, lawyers. I mean, this was just this is one of those topics that people didn't think about, but actually everyone's kind of got a little bit of a stake in.
What is your advice now in 2024 to the American producer through this year and then beyond?
I would say stay informed. There's still a lot of stuff coming out. One thing right now that came out just in January that most people don't know about, there is a law called the Corporate Transparency Act of 2021 that just actually went into effect in January. So everyone out there that owns a business entity, an LLC, an S-Corp, limited partnership, anything that you have to file with your Secretary of State's office, you are required by the end of the year to report this to the Department of Treasury, the U.S. Department of Treasury, who owns it, Social Security numbers, things like that. They're basically trying to find shell companies. There's criminal penalties if you don't do this. So this isn't the normal type of report. Like, every year, you always have to do an annual report to keep your LLC open, which is usually like a one-page form, and then you pay a fee. This isn't related to that at all. This is completely separate. You have to do it to the U.S. Department of Treasury. There's not a lot of people that know about it. But like I said, there's criminal penalties. They can fine you $500 per day if you don't file your paperwork before the end of December. So there's always things like this that are popping up, and I think it's really important for farmers to keep watching the news outlets, keep being informed, follow your ag publications, just stay abreast of what's going on.
Yeah, that is excellent advice, and I have heard about that one and was really wondering what's the implication to farms for that new regulation.
There's no exception. There's no exception for farmers.
Mm-mm. Wow.
So, yeah.
Very interesting. And yeah, good advice. Let's try as hard as we can to stay informed without getting, I guess, bogged down. That's the hard part, right? Trying not to get bogged down in trying to choose a side on every single issue. It's almost impossible. So I have one last question for you. Why do you serve the industry, and what are you most passionate about every day as you are serving in this capacity?
So for me, I've always been passionate about agriculture. I mean, I grew up on a farm. I hope one day to die on a farm. I also really liked policy. I really liked helping people. For me, the law was a great way to be able to kind of combine everything into one career. My favorite aspect of this is dealing with people all across the country. We talk to people from all walks of life on a daily basis, from lawmakers to attorneys to farmers. We can't give legal advice, but we can usually steer people in the right direction. And I've really enjoyed learning about the various types of agriculture. Like I said, I grew up on a ranch in Western Oklahoma. That type of agriculture looks nothing like the specialty crop operations in California or Michigan. It looks nothing like forestry operations or cotton farms in the Deep South. It's just, I'm constantly amazed at just how broad and diverse American agriculture is. And it's fun to learn more about it each and every day.
I couldn't agree with you more. Same thing, traveling around and seeing different types of farming and different methods and different climates is just, can just do it forever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Rusty, for joining me today. We'll have to do this again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And thanks to all who are watching or listening. If you want to learn more, the links are provided in the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe to North American Ag Spotlight on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Listen Notes. Or if you prefer video, you can find us on Rumble or Telegram channels or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like this episode, I'd love it if you shared it. Have a good day. Did you know that at NorthAmericanAg.com, we are committed to providing valuable resources for farms and agribusiness? Find your next podcast in the Best of Ag podcast library, delve into our on-demand webinar series, check out the latest in ag news, or treat yourself to a new hoodie or tee from our swag shop. Head over to our subscribe page to join our community and be the first to know about what's happening in the industry. North American Ag provides daily ag news and weekly podcasts covering ag tech, ag policy, new products, family, and faith. North American Ag gives farm families and ag professionals insight into what's happening in agriculture throughout North America. Ditch the mainstream media. Join North American Ag. Fastline Auctions, the ultimate destination for online farm equipment auctions. Looking to list equipment? Fastline Auctions knows farmers, and farmers have trusted Fastline for their equipment needs for over 45 years. With unmatched digital reach and direct-to-farmer catalogs, they can find the right buyer for your equipment. Not to mention, they have the industry's lowest commission rates. And if you're looking for equipment to buy, you can bid with confidence. No buyer premiums, no reserves, just integrity. Fastline Auctions, your trusted platform for hassle-free, cost-effective farm equipment auctions. Visit fastline.com for more information. You can join us for a tour of the Fastline Auctions platform July 13th at 6:30 p.m. To register for this webinar, go to northamericanag.com/fastline-webinar. That's northamericanag.com/fastline-webinar to register now.